Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and, well, for this next hour, they're going to be the views of Melody Randolph Miller, and we're going to be talking about her book, An Incautious Man. An Unconscious Man. And, of course, it's the story of Governor Morris. And, of course, you hear about Governor Morris. I've heard references to him, but I really didn't know much about him until, of course, I read Melanie's book. Melanie really has a fascinating career. She started out as an aeronautical engineer, and then she went to law school, and then she got a doctorate in history, which, of course, has always been one of my favorite subjects. And her book on Governor Morris really is, of course, in the backdrop of the American Revolution and the formation of the American Constitution. And then, of course, the French Revolution, where Governor Morris was actually in France. He replaced Thomas Jefferson, who came home to be the Secretary of State, and President Washington's administration. And it's really a fascinating insight into the history of that time. Melody, thank you so very much for being with us this evening. So basically, what motivated you to write, of all things, about Governor Morris?
Well, I got interested in him in a class on diplomatic history, reading about his time as our minister to France. And it was just such an amazing episode that it was hard to find anything that had been written about it. And after that, I began to get interested in his entire life and realized that actually he had had quite a bit more of an impact on our country than I had realized before. And he's a very engaging gentleman. It's a lot of fun to work on.
Well, of course, it's a lot of fun to read about that era, you know, and of course the things, the events that led up to the American Revolution, why the American Revolution, the vision of our country, the people who, of course, wanted to maintain relations with Great Britain, even though feeling it was wrong, but they didn't want to get involved on the side of the Patriots, and of course this split families. Even Governor Morris's mother was on the Loyalist side, as were other members of his family.
Yes, it was. I think that must have been quite painful for him and for his mother, too. But it wasn't uncommon. And after the war was over, there was no lasting bitterness, except I don't know how things were with his mother. She died a few years later.
All right, fine. Well, why don't you just start? Where would you like to start in the story of Governor Morris? And because, you know, he's a brilliant young man. He must have graduated from college when he was 16, and then, of course, became a lawyer. And you know, he was maybe 24, 25 years of age when the American Declaration of Independence was signed. How old was he? Pretty close to that.
Yes, well, he was born in 1752, so that's right. It would have been the age of 24. And I think he and many of his colleagues didn't really think it was going to come to war, even when the Declaration was signed. But he thought it through, and after a certain point, he decided that he would have to join the revolutionary side and put his considerable talents to the use of the revolutionary side.
And he did have a lot of talent. He was an excellent organizer. He could get ideas out, although some of his ideas differed very strongly with that of Jefferson. You point out that Jefferson believed in natural rights and that men should have this right of independence and freedom, whereas Governor Morris really believed you almost needed a powerful central authority and almost like a ruling aristocracy to control the masses.
Well, I don't think that Morris was in favor of a ruling aristocracy as such. I think that's one of the things that is clear in his discussions at the Constitutional Convention, that he was worried that America would end up being an oligarchy.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment. Well, Dr. Stan, our guest, of course, is Melody Miller. We're talking about her book, An Incautious Man, The Life of Governor Morrison. Would you like to explain to our listeners what he was governor of? I know because I read your book, but, I've always thought, what was he governor of?
It is confusing. Well, actually, he wasn't a governor of anything.
Okay.
His name, there is a debate about how to pronounce it. Some people actually think it should be pronounced, that it was pronounced governor over here in America, but it was a French Huguenot name.
Right.
And it's written gouverneur, so I just call him that to make it clear that people don't immediately assume he's was a governor.
But, of course, that was his mother's maiden name, wasn't it?
That's right. She came from an old Huguenot family that had come to New York. So he was sort of half Huguenot, half British. The name Gouverneur you'll actually see quite a bit in other families of that year. It was a big group of people that had that name.
All right, fine. So he really wasn't a governor at all, but he played an important part during the course of the Revolutionary War, although he wasn't necessarily a soldier, but he was certainly sent on a number of missions to evaluate the military activities. Would you like to talk about some of the things that he did and the significant part he played in the Revolutionary War?
Yes, well, because he had such a great ability to write eloquently but to also write quickly and clearly, he was put on committees. That was one of he said that's really what his talents were best suited to. During the time that he worked for the Continental Congress, he was on something like 65 committees, and he said at one point that he must have drafted nearly every document that came out of the Congress because he just could do it so well. And he worked with Washington in reforming the regulation of the of soldiers' pay and also the provisioning of the Army, which was really a critical issue. He went to Valley Forge and worked with Washington on these issues because one of the big problems in the war was corruption in the supply system. So he had quite a bit to do with getting that fixed up. And he also worked with a man named Robert Morris, who is pretty well known as what was called the financier of the Revolution. He was a wealthy man who really put his own fortune at stake in the Revolution. And they weren't related, but they became very good friends, and our Morris became his assistant.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment here with our special guest. Well, this is Dr. Stan. I guess this evening is Melody Randolph Miller. We're talking about her book, An Incautious Man. And it's the biography of a man who played an important part at the time of our revolution, at the time of the Revolutionary War, the writing of the Constitution. He was a contemporary, certainly, of Adams and Jefferson. And then, of course, he succeeded Thomas Jefferson as the ambassador to France at the time of the French Revolution. So the book first gives you a tremendous feeling of the history of that time. And since I'm a history buff as well, although I certainly don't have a doctorate in history as Melody does, it's a very, very informative book to try to see how all of these various things put together. And, of course, here was a young man who entered college at 12, graduated when he was 16, after he'd spent a year at home because he'd had an accident and a bad burn of one of his arms. And yet he caught up with his classmates at King's College and graduated at 16. He's a college graduate at 16, starts law as his father and grandfather had before him, but he must have had a very, very astute mind, and certainly the people who surrounded him must have recognized really his genius.
Well, and I think that his genius was something that not only attracted some people but also alienated others, because he did tend to be a bit exuberant and irrepressible, and sometimes people who didn't have a very good sense of humor were a little taken aback by Morris.
And you point out that he did do a lot of smiling, and he did have a good sense of humor, and which is why some people liked him, like Washington, and other people, like Adams, really didn't like him very much, like John Adams.
Right.
What was the differences between he and John Adams?
Well, Adams was older, and I think Adams was simply a much more sober-sided gentleman, and yet they both shared, I think, very much the same ideas about American independence, and both dedicated themselves to it. But Adams simply didn't have room for the kind of enjoyment that Morris took out of life, even when things were hard. And I think that on Morris's side, he probably had admiration for Adams, but thought of him a bit of a stick in the mud.
All right, fine. Well, now what about Jefferson, and what was his relationship with Jefferson, and how did he feel about these ideas of the Declaration of Independence and the natural rights of man that gave him the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness?
Well, I think with respect to the natural rights issue, I can only say that Morris initially did not support having a Bill of Rights in the Constitution, because he was one of those who felt it wasn't that he didn't feel that people had those rights, but rather that he felt that by listing them out, you were taking a chance of thereby implying that anything you didn't list wasn't included. So in that sense, he I think in Jefferson really were in disagreement. But his relationship with Jefferson is interesting because he first met him when he went to France. He overlapped Jefferson's time there by about 4 months, and Jefferson was very nice to him. He took a liking to Morris, and they walked around the city together and looked at monuments, and Jefferson pointed out things about architecture to them, and they discussed wine. And by the time Jefferson left, he really did like Morris. But after he came back to the United States, there were a lot of people who didn't like Morris and wrote negative letters about him to Jefferson. And after a while, Jefferson began to pull back. And their attitudes about the French Revolution also became quite different, which led to a tension between them.
Well, what was Jefferson's attitude towards the French Revolution, and how did it differ from that of Governor Morris? Because this was one of the major events of all time. Well, first of all, our revolution, the American Revolution, was the first in a series of revolutions. Ours was different than the French Revolution, because here in America, why, of course, our country was founded on Christian principles, limiting the power of government in France. Why, of course, they did away with religion. They thought they could create a perfect society without religion, and they wanted really an all-powerful government over there, quite different than what we seem to have had here. And then, of course, it went from bad to worse until they ended up with another dictator. But anyway, where did Jefferson and Morris, Governor Morris, disagree on the French Revolution? Because that is such an important issue in history.
I think that initially they actually had fairly similar views. They were both pretty skeptical about the ability of France to handle too much reform, and that they both thought that a constitutional monarchy was really the best that France could handle, as opposed to an American-type republic. But Morris stayed consistent with that belief and predicted from the outset that if they did go too fast, they would end up with essentially a despot in the end, which, of course, they did with Napoleon. But Jefferson, once he came back to the United States, he began to have other American political issues invested in having the French Revolution succeed, if whatever he meant by success. So it really it became inconvenient for him to see that things were really going to pieces over there. So I would have to say that In the time that I've spent examining it, I feel that Jefferson's attitudes maybe were a little bit less admirable than Morris's, because he really closed his eyes to the things he didn't want to see about what was going on over there.
Well, because you're going a great deal into the background of the French monarchy and how King Louis, of course, had really sort of kept dropping the ball time and time again as far as, you know, trying to placate the people and supporting of the new constitution that was written up. And he gradually just lost the support of the people. And the tragedy was, of course, that you have to have some structured government. Otherwise, you have anarchy and you end up like France did with the Reign of Terror.
That's right, and unfortunately, even though I think that Morris really felt that the king was well-meaning, he saw that he just didn't have the talent or the strength of character to be able to stay in charge of this kind of a major change of government. And of course, he was inevitably the scapegoat for everything that was wrong in France, even though it had been building for a very long time.
And of course, you, of course, make the point that there was an effort on the part of the aristocracy to stir up the passions of the people, you know, the idea, of course, the aristocracy is getting the people all up in arms, and then sometimes what they've done is they've created gets out of hand. Is that pretty well what happened in France?
Well, that's certainly how Morris viewed it, particularly with respect to the actions of people like Lafayette, who had come back from America full of enthusiasm for the American Revolution and wanting to institute similar reforms over in France, but not really able to understand that things like that had to be gradual and that the French really were not like Americans in terms of their cultural history and their experience with government, which was a lot different than what we were used to over here already. We had a lot of self-governing over here already, but they really didn't have that over in France.
They didn't have that tradition. Of course, the idea that they were going to create this utopian society under man without any religious restraints ended up eventually with anarchy and really terrible, terrible things.
Yes.
And, of course, at least we were coming from a strongly Protestant background. France was coming from a Catholic background, tremendous antagonism against the church over there because of its misuse of power. And then, of course, you destroy all the foundations of moral belief, and little surprise that it comes up as it did with the Reign of Terror. Well, what about Lafayette? Because I think he is such an important figure both in American history and in French history. And what was Governor Morris's relationship with him? And, of course, why did he stay on trying to gain Lafayette's freedom?
Well, he first met Lafayette over here. I think it was at Valley Forge they got to know each other, and they both liked each other. So that when he went over there, Jefferson was a good friend of Lafayette's by that time and was helping him try to write a new constitution for France and a new Bill of Rights. But Morris immediately started giving Lafayette advice about how to go about this and not to overdo it. And Lafayette really didn't want to hear this. There was a period where Lafayette was just about the most popular person in France, and Morris was very uneasy about that. He saw that, he said something like, every step he rises now is only going to accelerate his fall. And unfortunately, that's exactly what happened. When the king fell, Lafayette also was turned on by his own troops and had to flee. And he raced across the border, and he was captured actually by the Prussians. And he was thrown into Austrian prison, where he remained for the next several years. I think a lot of people don't know that he went through this. After Morris left France in 1794, and he spent the next several years in Europe, and a lot of the time he spent was trying, or a fair amount of time was spent trying to get Lafayette out of prison. He went to different courts. He went to the British to ask their help. And he went to Vienna and talked to the emperor's counselors about getting Lafayette out. And Lafayette was finally released in 1797, but it had been a terrible time that he spent there.
Well, why did the Prussians put him in prison?
Well, you know, it's interesting, but all the old courts of Europe really detested Lafayette because they held him responsible for the whole French Revolution and what was happening to France. And it's actually, he was, I think, lucky he wasn't executed.
Well, of course, he was actually responsible. He was part of this world revolutionary movement that he came to America to get a revolution, and he was over there in France. What part did he play in the French Revolution, fomenting the French Revolution?
He really had a lot to do with it. He led the, when Louis XVI was trying to get some financial reforms through before the revolution started, because France was in such bad financial condition. Lafayette led people into resisting that unless they were given certain reforms, and that included calling what was called the Estates General, which was a huge national assembly that they called, which really started the revolution, because once they were all called together, they never were able to get them apart again. And he was the head of the National Guard, which was sort of essentially of the military, and that gave him a great deal of influence as well. So the monarchs did not like him, and they did not trust him. Marie Antoinette particularly disliked him.
Did he back the king enough?
He backed a constitutional monarchy.
Okay,
but
I'll hold that. We'll be back in just a moment. Well, our guest this evening is Melody Randolph Miller, and of course we're talking about her book, An Incautious Man, The Life of Governor Morris, who lived at an amazing time and, of course, played an amazing part in the establishment of the United States and our Constitution. And of course, he was up there in New York at the time of the writing of the Declaration of Independence, and 5 days after the Declaration was signed in Philadelphia, he was, of course, urging the people in New York, the assembly up there, whatever it was, the ruling assembly or parliament there in New York, to sign the Declaration of Independence. At that point, then he put himself pretty well in line with the revolutionary movement. Now, we were talking about Lafayette. Is there anything else we should know about Lafayette and his belief in the world revolution, and certainly his wanting to overthrow the traditional monarchy of France and replace it with a constitutional monarchy?
Well, I think that Lafayette, we do owe Lafayette a great deal, and I think that in many ways he was a really good man, but at the same time, Morris saw that he was really very ambitious, and that he, to some extent, maybe wanted to make himself sort of the Washington of France, but he just didn't, he liked the adulation and the flattery, which was something that, of course, Washington really didn't care for, and I think Morris saw clearly that that was not going to work for him. So, you know, Lafayette came back over to America for a tour in the 1820s, and that's one of the reasons I think we have so many places named Lafayette all over the place, because he actually made an extensive tour, and they named little towns for him everywhere. But I think people should keep this story in mind, too. And one thing I would also mention is that Morris lent them a great deal of his own money to cover their debts while Lafayette was actually in prison. He helped his wife not only financially, but also helped keep her from being executed because she was arrested. And that's something also that I really admire Morris for.
Well, as you studied the history of that time, did you run into any of the relationships between Lafayette and Masonry, which was a very powerful movement at that time? And, of course, apparently Lafayette was a Mason, and this is one reason brought to the United States. Did you encounter any of that part of the history?
I have encountered it. I have to admit it's not something I've studied very much, although I think it would be very interesting to study it. Morris himself was not a Mason.
Right.
But I do know that Lafayette was involved in something called mesmerism.
Right.
The relationship of that to Mason, I don't really know much about.
Could you explain to our listeners what mesmerism is?
Well, it would be not a very accurate.
All right, fine. I won't pin you down. Basically, of course, mesmerize is almost like hypnosis. It's one of the metaphysical practices, and of course, it's really almost like taking control of somebody else's mind. At least that's my interpretation. But would that be good or bad as far as you're concerned?
Well, it certainly doesn't sound like anything that Morris, as a pragmatist, would have had much interest in.
I wouldn't think that Morris would know. I was thinking more of Lafayette.
Lafayette. Well, it does surprise me a bit that he would be involved in that. Of course, he was young. I think that this was back in the 1780s that he was involved in that, and so he was still pretty young and impressionable, but I can't say much about how it really influenced what he did.
Well, I think there were a lot of young people in those days that really were into this sort of thing, and we'll be back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Melody Miller, and we're talking, of course, no relationship at all to Governor Moore. And I said her name is Melody Randolph Miller. Anyway, we're talking about her book on Governor Morris, who was never a governor at all. That was just his first name, and that's who he's referred to. But he played such an important part, really, in the drafting of our Constitution. Now, if you're out there in the listening audience and have a question at all, our telephone number, of course, is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464 8295. Now, what part did Governor Morris play as far as the debates there in Philadelphia and the Constitution, the writing of the Constitution?
Well, he had an important role that I hope is going to get more study as time goes on. He represented Pennsylvania, even though he was a New Yorker, and he wasn't really eager to go because he had a lot of other things to attend to, but he felt it was such an important issue, and he felt so strongly that the Articles of Confederation had been so inadequate as a national government that he needed to go. So he was one of the, if not the most frequent speaker at the debates. He spoke something like 170 times. He popped to his feet. And in doing that, he gave some of the most eloquent and interesting speeches that were given at the convention that summer. They're really wonderful to read. You can find them online, and you know they're just very accessible. There's nothing that obscure about it at all. And he had a lot to do with the formation of the president's office and the power of the Senate. He also spoke out very passionately against slavery, but of course to no avail. It's just very interesting to see some of the different ideas they struggled with that summer and what they finally decided on. And I think that Morris, even if a lot of his ideas weren't adopted, brought a great deal more depth to the debate because of how well he spoke and how quickly he could analyze these issues.
And, of course, so you pointed out that he was even concerned about gender and gender issues as well. And the fact, of course, that our Constitution didn't necessarily give the right to vote to women?
Well, that's right, although I'm a little bit vague about whether or not he ever thought that women were likely to be getting the right to vote, although he did respect women and their political views very much. So I actually don't think that would have bothered Morris at all.
Well, did he believe in the concepts that were really so prevalent among our founding fathers that you had to restrict the power of government so it couldn't be oppressive on the people?
Oh, yes. I do think he felt that very strongly. In fact, you'll see that in his writings. As he was galloping out of Paris for the last time, he was talking about the bad state of France, and he was saying how much one's experience in life inculcates the notion that how you should never govern too much. But he did nevertheless feel that you needed a strong national government as opposed to a 13 different state governments and being in charge and just kind of getting along by treaty. He did feel that.
All right, fine. Well, I think he's a fascinating individual, and I think that it's so important that people understand the various ideas that were played out at that time and were brought in to begin to understand the ultimate decision to establish the American Constitution, which I personally believe is the finest document that's ever been written, and many, many people have tried to emulate it in the past. The tragedy is, of course, our leaders today, I do not, in my estimation, don't believe in the Constitution, and certainly most of the members of Congress have no idea what the Constitution is about, or the fact that they do not have unlimited power, that they are restricted by, as Jefferson said, the chains of the Constitution. Well, let's go to Robert, who's calling in from Spokane. Hi, Robert, you have a question for our guest.
Got a couple. Wasn't Governor Morris wasn't he the financier of the American War for Independence?
I think you're thinking of Robert Morris.
Robert Morris.
Robert Morris. Is that correct, Melody?
Yes. Uh huh.
Okay. So Robert Morris was the financier, although he was a friend of Governor Morris's, wasn't he, Melly?
That's right. Governor actually was his assistant during the last few years of the American Revolution.
But, of course, that's a point of confusion, so don't feel bad about it, because, of course, there's two Morrises, both involved very much with the Revolution, but one was Robert, the other was Governor. And I know that because I read Melody's book. Anything else, Robert? What's that?
Didn't he die in debtor's prison or something like that?
Robert did. Yes, he did. It was really a tragedy. He speculated in American lands, and he just put too much money into it and took too much risk. And actually, the years that Governor was in Europe, he was trying to help Robert save his situation. He was very distressed by it. He, he wrote to Robert in, a couple of years after he got there, and he said, why don't you just wind up your affairs? And
hold on, we're going to be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our telephone number, of course, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295, and our guest, of course, Melody Miller, and of course, we're simply talking about the background of the American Revolution and so many of the characters there, and Robert's calling. Robert, did you have another question?
Just a couple more. Well, first of all, a comment about Robert Morris dying in debtor's prison. It seems like a patriot that would finance the revolution. It's just hard to believe that they would allow him to die.
He didn't die in debtor's prison.
Pardoning him or something, you know.
Well, unfortunately, that's not the way the debtor's laws worked in those days, but he did not die there. He did get out, and Morris got, Governor Morris got together a group of people to help contribute to his to make him comfortable and to take care of his family while he was in there. So he died comfortable.
Okay. Hey, it is totally coincidental that I'm listening to this show. I'm just reading a book on the French Revolution, and it's not a really good book. So I'm wondering if you can recommend any good books, maybe written from a Christian perspective on the French Revolution.
Do you have a book you'd like to recommend, Melody?
Oh, boy, you know, my research is so piecemeal that everything I've seemed to look at is a chapter here and a chapter there.
Let me just suggest then to Robert, an excellent book would be Nestor Webster's The French Revolution. Nestor Webster, I don't know whether we carry it. We really should, and if you need help in getting it, we can point you in the direction. But it certainly is, to my way of thinking, one of the important books because it explains not what happened but why it happened. And, of course, the origin of the Jacobin movement, which played such an important part, and why these very wealthy people over there in France would, bring down the existing government. But anything else, Robert?
Yeah, one last comment on Marquis de Lafayette. I was just actually listening to my book on tape today, and they said that he was so popular in the first 2 years of the Revolution, but what brought him down is they had some insurrection events against the king, and his men or something shot like 50 of the people.
That wasn't the only thing that brought him down, but there was a mutiny, and Lafayette was trying to show that he could be strong and in control at a time when in other ways his authority was really clearly not nearly as strong as he would have liked it to be, and so he was responsible. Well, I don't know if he was directly responsible for that, but he was held responsible for that, and it definitely hurt his popularity.
And I think, they shot 50 of the mutineers, was that it?
I think that's right.
My wife says we carry the French Revolution by Nestor Webster, so there you are, Robert. You can get it from Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Melody Miller, and Sydney, she's written a wonderful book on Governor Morris, who the book is just fun to read. I've been enjoying it this evening. Our telephone number, if you'd like to call us, is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Robert, do you have another question before we let you go?
What was the name of that last book?
It's called The French Revolution by Nestor Webster. And, of course, Melody's book is An Incautious Man. And, of course, Melody's going to tell us where to get it. If you want to get that book on the French Revolution, I can put you on hold. You can talk to our producer. And then if you want to come back on, you can. Okay?
One more comment and I'll go.
All right. Hang on. My producer will take your call.
Okay. Seems like Lafayette had a big ego. What do you guys have to say about that?
Melanie, you're the expert on Lafayette.
I'm afraid that I do think that. Even Jefferson commented on it, that he had a canine appetite for fame.
All right, fine. Does that answer your question, Robert?
Thank you so much.
God bless. And hang on. We'll be right back in just a moment. Again, our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. And Melody, would you like to go ahead and put out your telephone number or tell people how they can get your book? Do you have a web page? What would you like to put out?
Well, the it's published by ISI Books, and so it's available on their website, and it's also available on Amazon. And
is that International?
Intercollegiate Studies Institute.
Intercollegiate Studies Institute, okay. Uh-huh. And it's available on Amazon as well.
Yes.
All right. Do you have a website or anything you'd like to get out?
I don't have one. I feel a bit antediluvian not having one. But,
oh, my goodness. How can you live without a website, without the Internet? Oh, anyway, I'm just of course, being a little facetious, but I will have to admit that my day begins going through my emails, followed by my checking certain websites, for the news of the day. That way I don't have to, wait until evening to find out what the news is. I have it at 6 o'clock in the morning before I start my 5 hours of radio. So anyway, if you're out there in the listening audience and you have a question on this subject, the subject of Governor Morris and, of course, the times in which he lived. Why, give us a call. Our telephone number 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And certainly in the discussions of the book, as a statement, that Governor Morris was one of the most important and arguably the most interesting of the American founders. Miller has captured the essence of the man in this book. Fascinating and highly readable volume. And, of course, here's a man extremely important, and most people have never heard of him. I mean, they certainly know Jefferson, Washington, Benjamin Franklin, John Adams, but very few people know Governor Morris. Why is that?
Well, of course, I think that it didn't help that his family estate was torn down in the 1800s because, you can go to Monticello and you can go to Mount Vernon, and those are wonderful places to go and get an idea of the people who lived there, Jefferson and Washington. But in Morris's case, the only place you're really going to find him, except if you go to the New York Historical Society and you can look at his wooden leg, is in his writings and in his diaries. But those are so wonderful, and they just make him seem so alive that I hope people will take more interest in him.
And, of course, you actually have gone through his papers and his diaries. And, in fact, aren't you the editor of the Governor Morris Papers and Diaries Project?
Yes. Well, there is no modern edition of his writings, and that, I think, is a shame. He started writing his diaries in France shortly after he arrived, and he kept that until he died. And they are really wonderful to read. And so I'm working on the period after he left France but before he returned to America. We're going to be publishing those within the next couple of years. And I'm hoping that will also help spark more research into him and just more interest. I hope more Americans just take an interest in him because I just think he's a national treasure.
How did you ever get from aeronautical engineering to law school to a doctorate in history? That's a rather strange odyssey.
Well, I think of myself as something of a professional dilettante. but I did really enjoy aviation. I worked for the FAA for really a number of years, but I decided I wanted to get a further degree, and I was in the campus store, and first I looked at the text on aeronautical engineering, and then I looked at the history textbooks on the shelves, and they were so much more interesting.
History really is a wonderful thing. I thoroughly enjoy it. In fact, I minored in history at when I was a pre-med student at the University of California. And I've always enjoyed history, and especially, trying to put together all of the events, of course, leading up to the American Revolution, why we had a revolution, why our revolution was so different than all of the other books out there, and really, of course, why our revolution was so different than all of the other revolutions that take place following that. And the world revolution is still going on. This is what people really don't understand. Mm-hmm. So anyway, of course, now, what sort of reception are you getting to your book?
Well, it hasn't been out very long, but I do think people are intrigued because they just haven't heard of him before. And this is exactly what I'm hoping for, is that people will start to enjoy him and do more research on him. You go to the library and there's shelf after shelf of books on Jefferson, but there's only a few inches on Morris.
And of course, the thing is, we have the internet. How fortunate we really are to be able to have at our very fingertips, you know, so much knowledge. In fact, the other evening we were doing a program, and somebody had, we were talking about gold and silver, and somebody gave a quotation from the Bible, from the Revelation, about throwing your gold and silver in the streets. Well, I just turned on my computer, and you know, in about 2 minutes, I had the quotation. It didn't come from Revelation; it came from Ezekiel. It had nothing to do with today. It had to do with the Jewish nation, you know, as it existed, you know, 2,500 years ago. And but it's so much information is so readily available. And I think it's just so important that people take advantage of it. It's really an exciting thing. In fact, what's really so interesting is that they don't publish Encyclopedia Britannica anymore because all the information is up there on the internet. We do have our old Encyclopedia Britannica, but the new one's just not forthcoming.
I agree. It's just astounding. We're using the internet extensively in our annotation of these diaries, and just the books that have been put online, the most obscure old books that you need about a sentence out of, and there they are.
Right.
It's wonderful.
And you don't have to buy that entire old book. That's a nice thing about it. Well, basically, of course, you even get into, Governor Morris's love life, because he had a number of loves. Did he ever marry?
Yes, he did, but quite late in life. He thought that he was a confirmed old bachelor, but he... only a few years before he died, he met a woman who actually he had known a little bit, some 20 years before, and she has an interesting story. Do you want me to talk about
sure,
that?
Sure, go right ahead.
Okay, well, her name was Anne Randolph, and she actually was related to through marriage to Patsy Randolph, Thomas Jefferson's daughter, but she had had a tragedy to happen to her in actually around 1790 while Morris was over in France, which was that she was living with her sister and her sister's husband, and she was engaged to the husband's brother, but he died, and not long after that it was rumored that she gave birth to a child, and she was accused of having, or was believed to have actually had that child by the sister's brother, by her brother-in-law, and it was a terrible scandal. And the man who was accused with her actually demanded to be defended by John Marshall, the future Supreme Court justice, Chief Justice, and they were cleared so that nothing criminal ever happened. But it tarnished her for good, and she was eventually kicked out of the family, and wandered about. And Morris found out about her being in New York at a boarding house around 1810, I believe it was, and asked her to come to be his housekeeper because he really did need help on his running his farmhouse or estate. And after a year or so, he asked her to marry him, and I think they were really very happy. She adored him. She was very lucky to have found someone like that.
Well, she certainly was, and certainly they lived happily ever after then.
Well, I think that they did. They had a child. It was only about 3 or so when Morris died, but I'm sure that gave him a lot of pleasure. She clearly realized that he was remarkable. He in his will, he provided for her, and he also provided that if she should get remarried, that she should get even more money. Not too many husbands would do that.
Well, of course, basically, of course, he'd come from a long line of lawyers, and apparently the family had always done very well financially.
Yes, that's true, but Morris was not the inheriting son. He had some older brothers who actually inherited the family estate, and he bought it from them. And so the money he had, he really made himself.
Didn't he make it predominantly as a lawyer?
Partly that, but also had a lot to do with land sales. He acted as an agent for many of the sales of huge parcels of land in upstate New York.
In fact, I noticed that I guess it was his grandfather who'd actually come to New York and bought up some property around a place called the Bronx, and he had something like 10,000 acres there. I don't know if it was in New York and New Jersey, very large tracts of land. So obviously he'd done fairly well.
Yes. Yes, but there were a lot of children, so it got parceled out quite a bit.
Right. Well, anyway, of course, this was a whole different time, a whole different era, a whole different set of social values. Well, Sidney, what are some of the other really important things, as far as Governor Morris? You could talk about his influence on the writing of the Constitution, on the debate surrounding the Constitution. Go ahead.
Well, one thing I meant to mention in connection with the constitutional debates was that with the Constitution itself, is that even though many of his ideas weren't adopted that summer, and some of the delegates got pretty unhappy with him, particularly for his speeches against slavery, he was still given the job of drafting the final version of the Constitution. And we can thank him for its polish. He wrote the preamble, and that's really something I think that is important to remember about him, that he took the original preamble language, which was just a list of the 13 states, and instead he changed it to say, "We the people of the United States." And that was a very important element to that document, which was it forced it to become a national document, to establish a national consciousness. And that phrase, "we the people," is something everybody knows, but it's important to remember that that was Morris who wrote that, and he wrote it very deliberately.
We've always thought that, of course, it was Madison who was the author of the Constitution, but really was Morris played an important part in finishing it off?
Oh, yes. I wouldn't disagree that Madison was deserves to be called the father of it. He drafted the original parts that were used for the debates that summer. But Morris had a lot to do with many of the design elements, and not only that, he did write that final, he took all those parts and put them together and made it a coherent whole, which was a pretty important thing to have done.
Well, it really is a magnificent document, very simple and yet very straightforward, very readable. It was designed so the average individual could understand what our form of government was all about. I mean, here, we hear about them coming up with some new bill, in Congress, there's 23,000 pages. Nobody's going to read that. I mean, the Constitution is very simple. But it was meant to be simple because it was a document for the people, so that the people would understand that the federal government was not to provide for them. They were to provide for themselves. And, of course, it was this alliance between the aristocracy at that time and the common people that made our form of government so unique. Would you agree with that?
Yes, I would. And I think the genius of that document is the checks and balances concept. And that was something that Morris felt so strongly about, that he was accused of being an aristocrat, but he felt, he said in one of his speeches that the rich will strive to enslave the poor, they always have, they always will, and that the proper security against them is to invest them in the government by essentially, he thought of them as being in control of the Senate, and that the House would be the representation of the non-rich, and that by giving each part a role to play, that you would end up with the best mix and the best form of government.
Of course, it was very, very similar to the British Parliament, where you had to be House of Lords and your House of Commons.
That's right. But as far as the design of the executive went, too, that was an important another part of the check and balance, which they really didn't have much experience on designing, because there hadn't been an executive during the Articles of Confederation era.
And, of course, the whole idea, of course, that the most powerful form of government, a part of government, was to be the elected legislature, and not certainly the executive branch of government, which was simply to actually carry out the dictates of Congress, although the president could veto the bills, but then Congress could override the veto. So it really was an ingenious means by which you had to have overwhelming support if you were going to override a president's veto.
That's right. Actually, Morris really had hoped for an absolute veto for the president, because he saw the president as something that his function was to protect the people against the excesses of the legislature.
But then how do you protect the people against the excesses of the president?
That's where the legislature comes in, and also, of course, the judiciary. So it just each Madison kind of accused him of focusing too much on the depravity of people. But I think that was just realistic of Morris, that this is human nature. It's always been this way, and that the only way to solve this is to, equation is to put all these parts with strengths of their own.
And nothing has changed at all, from the time of ancient Greece and ancient Rome to the time of the founding of our country, right up to this present day.
Right.
And, of course, I think right at the present time we're seeing a move in Congress this week, of course, to really, of course, give massive power to a man, Hank Paulson from Goldman Sachs, who is going to part of the problem, created the problem in Washington, D.C., and now we're going to give him total and absolute power over the economy of our nation to solve the problem that he and his cohorts created. And once again, of course, we see this eternal battle between those who would be free and those who would enslave the masses. And unfortunately, most people don't even understand that battle goes on because they don't understand the arguments that went on at the time when our Constitution was created. Would that be a fair statement?
Well, I think that's right, and those things are really accessible. People shouldn't be afraid to learn about them.
And I think it's a fascinating read. Once again, the title of the book is An Incautious Man, and the author, Melody Randolph Miller, available up on Amazon, and excellent, excellent read. Well, Hudolf will be back in just a moment to wrap up today's program. Well, Melanie, you have 3 minutes to wrap up the program. What message would you like to leave with our people out across America, out across the world?
Well, I just would like to say that it's worth taking a look at Gouverneur Morris, because he not only is it important to remember him as a founding father, but just because he's very interesting and enjoyable, and there's no reason we can't enjoy our founding fathers. So, he was someone who enjoyed life enormously, and that's something we can all take a lesson from. One thing I haven't mentioned is that he was only 28 when he lost his leg in a carriage accident, and that must have been a terrible ordeal. But he really never complained about it, and he went on to live a very full and interesting life. It didn't slow him down, and that's also something that is worth keeping in mind when you think about him.
And, of course, you talk about this terrible burn that he had on his arm that incapacitated him for the better part of a year, and yet he never really complained about that either, did he?
No, he didn't. In fact, you really have to search long and hard to find any mention of it at all to prove that he had it. So, and that's also, I think, quite admirable.
But I think one of the things you brought out is that he liked to smile, and he liked to laugh, and he had a very jovial sense of humor.
He really did, and I think that's one of the reasons that Washington enjoyed him so much, was that he was kind of a relief, especially during the darkest days of the Revolution.
And, of course, here's an opportunity to meet a lot of the people who founded our country, and certainly Washington always comes through, at least almost everything I've read about him, as a dominant figure that was admired, this old idea of first in war, first in peace, first in the hearts of his countrymen, was not simply a label. He really was universally or almost universally admired and respected, wasn't he?
Yes, he was, and Morris really never respected anybody else as much as he admired Washington. He was one of the group of people kind of called Washington's surrogate sons. And other people did backstab Washington quite a bit. And I have to say, including Jefferson, but Morris never lost his admiration for Washington.
In fact, when you read, of course, things written about Washington, he always felt that God had protected him in battle after battle. When he should have died, but God had protected him for a purpose. And, of course, that's, I think, why, of course, he foregoed his opportunity to retire, and why he was willing to, certainly stay on, head into Constitutional Congress, and then, of course, eventually become the first President of the United States for 2 terms. And then, of course, he wouldn't take a 3rd term. He felt, of course, power should be turned over to others. We're out of time, Melody. God bless you. Thanks so much for being with us. Look forward to talking to you later this week.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we do hope that you've enjoyed our conversation with Melanie Miller on her book, An Incautious Man. Of course, it's available on Amazon. It's a small book. It's easy to read, but got a lot of great history in it. Well, of course, this is the time when I need to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported, and we're really dependent upon those of you who listen to our programs to help us. And we know it's tough times for a lot of people out there, and I hate to tell you this, but times are going to be a lot worse than they are right now. But we're going to get through this one way or another. Only question is, what's life going to be like in America after we've gone to a financial dictatorship under the former CEO of Goldman Sachs, who created most of the problems we're having today? But of course, nobody ever asked that, or where the $700 billion is that they're going to be authorizing this week. Because right now we're having to borrow $2.5 billion a day just to pay our bills. So where are they going to come up with the $500 trillion they gave away to foreign banks last week, or the $700 billion they're talking about now, or the $1 to $2 trillion that they're going to lose because they took over Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac? And, well, I'll tell you where it's going to come from. It's going to come from your future, your pension fund. It's going to come from your bank account, the value of your bonds, your insurance company, as they destroy the value of our currency. And you have to understand what's going on today. If you have not yet read the book, The Creature from Jekyll Island, you need to get it ordered. We sold, I think, somewhere well over 40 copies of The Creature from Jekyll Island today. It's written by our good friend Ed Griffin. I've known Ed for 46 years, but this is his finest work. And it really goes into an understanding of money and debt. And, of course, you have to understand that, of course, all debt, all money is based upon debt. You destroy debt, you destroy money, and debt is dissolving very, very rapidly today. And with that, of course, is the very real possibility of the impoverishment of our people. You need to get the book, The Creature from Jekyll Island. You need to read it three times and study it so you'll have some idea what you can do today to protect yourself. You need my talk on the financial tsunami, and the syllabus goes with that. It's a talk we did 2 years ago, but there's not one word in it that I would change today. Other than that, I was telling you what was going to happen, and it's all coming to pass today. That's the financial tsunami. The talk is available on DVD or on video, and the syllabus, of course, is available as a syllabus. And then, of course, we have the little pamphlets on the history of money and the financial meltdown. Now, you can go up on our internet site and pull those down. There's letters, or you can buy the inexpensive booklets that we put together, about five newsletters in each one. But information you need to have to understand what's really going on today. That's The History of Money and the Financial Meltdown. The other two books, well, we carry other books. We carry, of course, The Federal Reserve Conspiracy by Professor Sutton, who was a friend of ours before he passed away some years ago. And then, of course, the book, The Fiat Money Inflation in France. We also carry Professor Sutton's book, Gold for Investment and Gold for Survival. And believe me, the price of gold was up $30 or $40 today. Silver was up $1 an ounce. Great fortunes are going to be made and lost before this is over. And most people have no idea what is really transpiring in the world today. So again, our number, 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-544-8927. And then, of course, let me remind you, we are having our all-day seminar. It's going to be held at the Aptos Seascape Golf Course here on the North Shore of Monterey Bay on the 26th of October. That's the 26th of October. We do hope many of you can come. We're bringing in, of course, Joanna Michelson, who is a medium, and she'll tell you about her experience with the other dimension and the supernatural. Then, of course, Dr. Russell Blaylock will be here talking on health. Patrick Wood from the Office for Review was a good friend of Professor Sutton's as well, and wrote extensively with him in the late 70s, is going to be here talking about what's happening financially and what you must do to protect yourself. Remember, if you want to come, you have to have a reservation because we're serving lunch. Give us a call, 1-800-544-8927. And then please pray for America, pray for revival, pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, these behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and, well, for the next hour, they're going to be the views of Barry Shamish, who's an Israeli patriot, an Israeli citizen, who actually had to leave Israel and come to the United States because of threats against his life. And he gives us a regular weekly update somewhere during the course of our weekly programs on what is really going on in Israel today. So with that as a background, Barry, are you there?
I am.
All right, fine. You pick up the story and go with it.
Yeah, I'm not going to do the news till later. I'm tired of these psychopathic, corrupt officials playing games. I'm going to talk about some major whistleblowing that happened in Israel this week. And the first is a rare opportunity to understand what happened during the Gush Katif, or the pullout of the Jews of Gaza. And it turns out that the Israel Defense Forces has a department called the Behavioral Sciences Branch, and they use heavy psychology against its soldiers to get them, against their will, to evacuate Jews from their homes, something truly I would have believed at one point was impossible, but, well, I was one of the few who said they will, in fact, evacuate the Jews from Gaza, just knowing the background. But there was a suit submitted by a doctor, a psychologist, Dr. Amina Dor, against two psychiatrists employed by the IDF to change Israeli soldiers into an evacuation army, into an army used against civilians. Actually, the suit itself said to nullify soldiers' instinctive opposition to the expulsion and make them obey any command given to them. The suit, which was submitted to the Israeli Board of Psychologists, was against two psychologists, Doctors Nachi Ayalon and Chaim Omer, for unethical and damaging use of their profession, including the use of hypnosis. Now let's talk about what that means. It means that they wrote a paper 7 months before the evacuation that was distributed throughout the IDF, and it was called Mental Preparations for the Disengagement Mission. And what they had to do is to change the entire mentality of the Israeli army.
But don't you think, of course, this is just a standard manipulative technique? I mean, the elite always want to manipulate us common people, and certainly we, in the United States, we manipulate our army. Certainly in Germany, they manipulated their army. That's how they got the Germans to commit all the atrocities to German soldiers. They knew it was wrong, but our soldiers are manipulated too. In fact, they have to teach them how to kill. It's not normal to kill. They play psychological games with them. You know, even video games to teach them to kill, just as, of course, they were playing those games on the members of the Israeli army to get them to expel their own Jews. Go right ahead, Barry.
Well, don't forget this was not to kill. It was to, their words are in this horrible I mean, really, it's a horrible thing to read. Their words were emotional disconnect, spiritual inoculation, and thought control. This was the actual, with great pride, they were bragging about the manipulation of soldiers' behavior. And we can't talk about really the black day in morality that went into this paper they wrote for the army. It's simply beyond what the Israeli army was ever created for, was to declare war against Jews. But that's what they had to do. And what they did is, it's horrible to read. It truly is. Now let's, on the broad scale, they have the highest ranking Israeli officers called the very best youth in Israel. I mean the most idealistic youth in Israel. Well, they were the pioneers of Israel. They braved incredible risk to make the Gush Katif was the province of the Gaza Strip that the Jews lived in. They turned these youth, they called them infiltrators. They told the Israeli public that these youth who were arrested, held for months on end in horrible camps, the Israeli public were told that they're more dangerous than Hezbollah. They prepared the Israeli public to just despise really the best youth they had in Israel. And this was done on purpose. But more daunting, I think, is they invented a new ideology. And I can't believe it works. You know, it didn't work on me, but I guess it worked very well on 18, 19-year-old kids. The new ideology was that democracy is more important than being Jewish, which, of course, is the exact opposite of why there is an Israel Defense Forces, but that's the message that was shoved down their throats, that the IDF was the protector of democracy.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back, Barry.
Right.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Barry is just talking about the psychological games. Psychological methods were used to condition the Jewish military, young, idealistic 18, 19-year-old boys in the Jewish IDF force, and, of course, to tell them, you know, of course, that democracy was more important than being Jewish, and you know, that the purpose of the army was to protect the people, and all sorts of lies to get Jews to attack Jews. And, of course, the Israeli military went in and by force evicted the people from their homes and, you know, in Gaza. And of course, but you have to control people's minds to get them to do the wrong things. They do this sort of thing in our schools that take away the morality of our kids, and they condition them to do certain things that they want them to. And, of course, they do this with our military. They're doing it with all of our citizens. All these psychological games, whether it's done with television, whether it's done with radio, whether it's done with books, whether it's done in courses, whether it's done by a reward system, we are being constantly manipulated. After all, they have a department in government called the Department of Human Resources. We're not human beings. We're simply resources, and that's just what they're doing over there in Israel to the Israeli military, just exactly what the Germans did to the German military during the Second World War to commit terrible atrocities against their fellow Germans. Go right ahead, Barry.
Well, this was done with a phony heart behind it, a Jewish mentality. They had to deal with the thinking of the population, and what they said is to the soldiers was the failure to carry out the evacuation mission means that you failed at democracy. And believe me, the Jews have a terrible problem with democracy, because their country simply is not democratic. by any stretch of the imagination. Now, what they told the soldiers was that they would be contributing to the community, that their mission, the evacuation, was a mission within the family. If you can believe this poppycock, but I was there and I saw it on TV. They had a slogan for the whole army that the evacuation would be carried out with sensitivity and determination. I heard that in the news every day. It would be a sensitive evacuation, but a determined one. And the result, and this is straight from the report, was to create a friendly, considerate, weeping, embracing non-combatants. And this was to fool both sides. In other words, when the Jews evacuated people from their homes, they would weep with them and they would embrace them. And both sides somehow would think the evacuation was a good thing because the soldiers were so considerate. It's a new strategy to create utter evil, but it's a strategy of sensitivity to forcing people out of their very beautiful homes, I want to tell you. Now, what they did with the locals, that's my book, Bye-Bye Gaza. It's what I wrote about, that the actual residents of Gush Katif, they picked Quislings from the locals, rabbis, which I have commented on at great length, and again, that's in my book, Bye-Bye Gaza, how they turned the rabbis who served the community into Quislings, into capos. And capos, by the way, were the Jews who were used by the Nazis and were allowed to survive a little longer. One of the great problems with Judaism, well, not Judaism, with European Jewry, with the Holocaust, a problem noted by Primo Levi, an Italian chemist who I believe won the Nobel Prize, was that the Jews who survived the Holocaust were not the good Jews. They were the Jews willing to do whatever the Nazis told them to do. And there may have been Jews who survived because they were the last ones taken into the camps, but the ones that survived the whole Holocaust, years of it, were doing the work the Nazis asked of them. So when you talk about Holocaust guilt, and it's not just because why did I survive, it's the question of what I did to survive, and there is the best Jews died, the ones that were willing to compromise their morality survived. It was the only way to survive, and I personally can't judge it. The situation was too severe, but it's a problem that the survivors of the Holocaust, only 100,000 out of 6 million wherever the Nazis showed up, they got almost all the Jews. The Jews that did survive were doing vital but dirty work for the Nazis. They were called the capos. What the Israeli army did is they found capos in Gush Katif, including rabbis, security officers, and social workers who prepared the ground for the evacuation. And then they were rewarded by the army on the days of the evacuation, and there weren't many, by the way. They were given glowing orange vests to be identified as the good people, the people, your neighbors, who were, in fact, working with the army. They in fact, betrayed their own communities. And I don't know how they found people like this, but there's some flaw in human nature where you could find capos. And this is what they did. They went looking for the weakest rabbis, the weakest social workers who lived in Gush Katif, and they used them for the evacuation. And this was all planned. I wrote about it at great length, but it was all planned by the army. It was the dirtiest trick you can imagine, but that's what Jews did to Jews during the evacuation of Gush Katif. Now, also in this report, and thank goodness we have one whistleblower. Without Dr. Amina Dorr, the public wouldn't realize the extent of the dirty tricks used to turn 10,000 and more Israeli soldiers into robots with glowing eyes who put Jews not on cattle cars this time around. They put them on buses, and the Jews walked out with their hands in the air and walked into the buses. It was no different than the Holocaust. It really wasn't. And some of the strategies, the soldiers, for instance, it was not a large attack like, well, in Lebanon, I could talk about the Lebanese War where you were part of an army. The soldiers were separated into tight-knit groups, and they were given 1 month before the evacuation to prepare. Now, how they got the soldiers prepared, they gave them just simply unbelievable conditions during the training for the evacuation. Air-conditioned tents, a TV in every tent. And believe me, if you're a soldier, I never had an air-conditioned tent. And there was one TV for the whole base. Suddenly they got the equivalent of great conditions. They were given free restaurant passes. They were encouraged to participate in social and sports activities. By the time the expulsion came along, they just viewed it as a game. Nothing more than being part of this close-knit army. But the ugliest part is they had to wear black uniforms. And I've never understood why black is used so often by the bad guys. But they were given black uniforms with the Star of David on the chest.
Of course, it actually really sort of strikes fear in the people that you're oppressing. It's the same thing the Nazis were. You know, the SS uniform was always a black uniform. And, of course, you'll see the ninja people. Here, the people that are coming in to take on demonstrators now, very often they'll be all dressed in black.
Well, that makes sense. The SS, though, were brown shirts.
No, there were brown shirts that were different. The brown shirts were different than the SS. The brown shirts were actually most of them were killed. A lot of them were homosexuals. They were done away with, and then of course replaced by the SS.
Well, the Jews wore black. The evacuators wore black with a big Star of David on the chest, and according to this report, that was to instill pride. Oops, I hear the music.
You hear the music? We've got about 20 seconds to wrap up, and we'll be right back.
They were proud of evacuating Jews in their black shirts with a Star of David on it.
What happened when the Jews resisted? Because some of them didn't want to leave. It was their home. It was their property.
No one left with so much as a bruise on him.
Right. They went right along with it, huh? Marched right off into the camps. Well,
yes,
of course, they didn't go to concentration camps. They went to apartments, but of course, apparently...
No, they didn't. They went to hotels and then nothing. After 10 days, they were thrown up the street.
All right, hold on. We'll be back in just a moment with Barry Sammons telling about the tragic evacuation of Gaza where Jewish soldiers forced people to leave their homes and their heritage. Go right ahead, Barry.
Well, I'm going to go on to another whistleblower.
All right, fine. What's going to happen as far as that suit is concerned? Is it going to get any place at all? Do you think that the psychologists over there would have the courage to throw out these people who compromise their profession to help the fascist element in the Israeli government?
They haven't got a thing to worry about.
Right.
But at least someone is trying, and that's the best you can hope for.
Well, I think that the doctor who's doing that should be commended. Is it a woman?
It certainly is.
All right, fine. Well, maybe she's got more courage than most of the men over there. Go ahead.
Apparently, she's suing two men. Apparently, that's the case. But I'm going to bring up a very brave man who should have opened his mouth years ago. He's a broadcaster and a very well-known one in Israel, Dr. Guy Bechor. He wrote a report on the Israeli media. And because he is so well-known in Israel, this report is being read. I don't know if anything can be done. I mean, you asked the question that if something could be done about anything, I suppose I'd be back in Israel doing it, but I don't think anything can be done. He calls the media an occupying force. In his report, what he claims is, as the Israeli political left has all but disappeared, in fact, the Labor Party and Kadima, Olmert's party, are supported by as many Arabs as Jews. The Jews have simply abandoned the left, which is, of course, what you're supposed to do. These are the Sabbateans of which I write. But he says the media has replaced the left-wing political parties, and it's doing the job of the left that no longer exists as a political force. Now, this report, again, it really is deeply revealing, but you have to be Israeli to understand what it reveals. I'll give one example. I'll give two. One, he claims that the media in Israel, and we're talking about really except for a marginal religious media, which is ineffective. You're talking about the mainstream media. He says they despise Middle Eastern or Sephardic Judaism, yet they love Islam, which makes no sense. They hate the Middle East and all its values, but they claim to love them, which, of course, if you read the Israeli media, that's exactly right. And Dr. Bechor talks about how they stay away from the religious Jews, which, you know, right now most Israelis are religious. They hold their meetings on the Sabbath, on Friday to Saturday evening, where no religious Jew can ever show up. And they create a cocoon that way. And if you don't agree, you just don't work. And by the way, I know that. Believe me, I was a lone wolf in Israel, where I created my own work.
All right, hold on there, Barry. We'll be back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our telephone number, if you'd like to call in, 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. Our guest is Barry Shamus, and he's talking about a report that was put out by a very courageous gentleman who apparently has been well-known, worked in the media over there in Israel. And he's put out a report that's saying what, of course, I'm sure is true, and which is very, very similar to what's going on here in the United States, and that is that the Israeli media has been taken over by the left, and if you try to fight it, you don't go along with it, why, you're not going to work over there. And here in the United States, if you put out the truth, why, you're not going to keep a job working. I know, because you can be the establishment, you can be a Rush Limbaugh, which is, of course, the establishment, conservative person, just as first you have the people that the establishment's liberal, but they control both sides of the discussion, the liberal, the conservative. But if you really try to get the information out, why, with very rare exceptions, you're not going to exist, and if they did not want a token force on the other side, you would not hear them at all. So basically, that's what's going on in Israel. So do you think that the average Israeli has any idea how controlled the press is in Israel today?
Oh, yes, they do. They hate the media. And I'm talking about the majority know the media is manipulating them. Absolutely, they do. But you get an insider who exposed it. What he's doing really is collaborating what the average Israeli already knows.
Right. Go ahead.
Well, what he claims is that all this media, all this, what he, again, he calls it a media occupation, a takeover. He said no more than 20 people are in charge of the Israeli media, and they create the conditions, and everyone has to play along. They're the publishers, they're the editors, and you just can't fight them. Now, the next, well, she's not a whistleblower, but I'm going to talk about something before I do Olmert's so-called resignation, and believe me, it's not a resignation. He resigned, but he'll stay in power all the way till January, it looks like. But I'm going to talk about Olmert's brother, Yossi. Now, I'm bringing it up. I spoke with an old friend from Israel last night. She's living in Nevada right now. And she told me about Yossi Olmert, who's working for the Jewish Agency. And she came to him with a media project to try and improve Israel's image. And she had a long meeting with him, and he was, she said, very threatening. He kept repeating, "You better tell me everything about who you are. We'll find out." He kept saying, "We have ways of finding out," which is really quite also a little too German for my case or hers. So she said, "I admire Rabbi Kahana," and she never worked again. That was it. She never worked again. She was finished after that one statement. Rabbi Kahana and Yossi Olmert is theoretically from the right. I mean, that's what they told us. And there should have been some admiration for Kahana, but of course there was none whatsoever. He was despised by everyone in the mainstream. But I'm going to talk briefly about Olmert's brother. If you think Olmert is corrupt, his brother had to leave Israel because of, well, the mafia. Everyone says the mafia. He owed money to the mafia. He ran out of Israel for America. Now, I'm going to give a little tip. He's got an American wife, and she is a true blue infiltrator. The real thing, she supposedly has a tour company that books tours to Israel. It's supposedly headquartered in Netanya. Now, I was with her at one conference where she played a role in getting me thrown out, the only conference in my life I've been thrown out of. And I watched her at work. She was spreading, what we call left-wing propaganda. And I was telling this, and I said, how can you tell these naive Christians this Israeli leftist stuff? I said, they're gone. They're not even on the political map anymore. And she told me, honestly, she was right about this. She said, Kadima is the left.
Now, we're going to explain to our listeners what Kadima is.
Well, her brother-in-law, Ehud Olmert's party.
No, Kadima is a political party in there. It's the left-wing political party.
It's not left-wing. It came out of the Likud. In theory, it's not a left-wing party, but it is.
All right, we'll be back in just a moment.
Hey.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here. I guess this is Barry Shamish. We're talking about certainly Olmert's brother and his wife, who is apparently very much involved with the left wing, which of course is about half Arab and half a radical leftist there over in Israel. But before we go on, we've got Mike calling from Santa Cruz. Mike, did you have a question for our guest?
Yes, Sam, I have a question, and if you'd rather save this for another time, that's okay. I, of course, would like to. I would love to get Barry's take on the story of the USS Liberty.
I think that's probably a little off the unless you have anything you'd like to say about that, Barry.
Well, I can add in my time, I have actually communicated with officers of this ship who tried to persuade me of their eyewitness account, and I worked with a British documentary maker. He was going to do a Rabin film, and BBC did accept it. Now, what is his name? I forgot his name. He was thrown out of Israel a few years ago for backing Vanunu, which really was a very stupid thing to back. But neither here nor there. The overall point of view I've been hearing is that. In short, the attempt by Israel was to drag the United States into the war against Egypt. Initially, the boat was going to be sunk and Egypt was going to be blamed, and then the United States would come into the war on Israel's behalf against Egypt. But again, this is still supposition, there are reasons to believe that that is certainly the Israeli establishment way of thinking, is you create a crime and blame it on someone else.
But don't you think, of course, they were working in concert with high officials in the American government as well? The Israelis could never have done that and got away with it without a tremendous help from people at the highest levels of the American government.
Reuben Johnson, right. Who did bury the story immediately. So, I mean, that's what I've heard, anyway.
All right, I think that's an honest appraisal. Mike, does that answer your question?
Good enough for now. Thanks a lot, Sam.
All right, fine. Thanks very much. And, of course, that's Mike calling from Santa Cruz asking about the story of the USS Liberty. And we're going to, of course, put together a four-tape set on that, which will come up with a very, very similar conclusion to Barry's. We'll be back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest, of course, is Barry Shamish. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And Sydney Barry has been talking about Mr. Olmert's, the Prime Minister's brother, who, of course, apparently had fled Israel. His wife apparently is very much involved with the left, has some sort of a travel company, but Barry's had an opportunity to talk with her. Do you have anything else you want to say on that issue, Barry? You want to go on to something else?
If you have a Christian conference somewhere and she shows up, just know she's working for the security services, and she's up to no good.
All right, fine. Well, before we go on then, Barry, let's go ahead and tell our listeners how they can get your DVDs, how they can get your books, and how they can, of course, get your website.
Well, the books, and for tonight's discussion, Bye Bye Gaz is the book to get. You go to www.lulu.com, lulu.com. There's a box that says search right in my name, Chamish. That's Shamish, and you'll see the books. The website is barrychamish.com. I'll leave a phone number. I have a brand new DVD, which I'll get to you. I'm busy burning them right now. It's my lectureship, Tide Sea Labor Zionism and the Holocaust. If you want it, you just phone me, and my number is 904-315-8079. That's 904-315-8079. I suppose we should talk about Olmert's resigning and C.P. Livni taking over the leadership of the Kadima Party. Just keep in mind, Olmert did not resign as such. He is going to be prime minister until Livni forms a coalition, and she has 42 days to do it, and it looks like she might not be able to. If not, well, then he's got himself another 42 days. In other words, he's going to be prime minister, if all goes according to his plans, until the beginning of next year. January is the final day of the Bush administration. It's the final day of Mahmoud Abbas's term as president of the Palestinian Authority, and it looks like Olmert will be there to leave Israel in an impossible security situation. But the thing about Livni you should know is that the party elections were thoroughly, thoroughly rigged by her, and she's got lawsuits coming at her every which way. In short, she won by about one percentage point, but on the evening of the party elections, she asked for and was granted an extra half hour of voting so she could get her people, a whole pile of Arabs, into the polling stations in a hurry to vote for her. And her people somehow or another rescinded the results of a very pro... Well, her opponent was Shaul Mofaz, the defense minister. And in the town of Rahat, they voted pretty well all for Mofaz. Somehow she got the whole polling booth canceled on the night of the election. Mofaz would have won just from Rahat, I've heard. In short, she also put her members of the Knesset were present at the actual vote counting. By all accounts, it was a thoroughly rigged election, and she's going to go to court over it. But again, in the Israeli style, it won't make a difference. It just won't make a difference.
All right, fine. Well, let's go to Mario, who's giving us a call from Flint, Michigan. Hi, Mario. How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing just fine. Speak right up there.
Okay.
Go ahead.
I have a question for Dr. Chambliss.
Dr. who?
Chambliss. No, doctor. I have an M.A., but I don't think I get a... I get to be called a doctor over that.
Usually on this show, it seems like it's a doctor.
All right, well it's just that we can call him master. Go ahead. Do you have a question?
Sorry about that. Concerning your story about the evacuation of Israeli citizens, is it from the West Bank?
No, it's from the Gaza Strip.
From the Gaza Strip.
Now, Gaza is down south of Israel. It's separated down there and stationed at the Sinai Desert. But Gaza, of course, was a very prosperous enclave. People had been there 40 years or more. They had beautiful homes. They had a very, very productive. They were growing a lot of the fruit that was used not only in Israel, but, of course, the vegetables that were used all over Europe. Leaders of Israel were intent upon turning Gaza over to the Arabs. As they turned the West Bank, they wanted to turn Samaria and Judea over to the Arabs. The leaders of Israel want to destroy Israel, but they can't.
One question about that, though. I remember that Ariel Sharon, early from the beginning of his administration as prime minister, he was a strong ally of the religious right in this country and in Israel.
Never, never. Ariel Sharon was a secular left-wing prime minister, totally allied with the left.
Well, was our media misleading us?
Because, absolutely.
Oh, boy.
George Bush was a strong ally of the religious right until the issue of our relationship on the southern border with Mexico came into the forefront, and Now nobody sees him the same way anymore.
I think, Mary, you have to understand that the media lies to us. It creates our impressions that have very little to do with reality. Barry's on the front lines of this, and of course, Sharon may very well have said what the Christians in this country wanted to hear, but he was neither pro-Christian nor was he pro-Israel. He was really an internationalist, but a secular internationalist. Would that be accurate, Barry?
Yeah. Well, he was controlled, and I do mean controlled, by the Council on Foreign Relations. He never, ever went to the United States without meeting Henry Kissinger. That was his handler. You know, if we ever want to talk Sharon, I'll be more than happy to clear up the issue there. Sharon was placed in the Israeli right. He had a left-wing political party called Shalom Tzion. He melded it with the Chayrut party of Menachem Begin to form the Likud. And from the formation of the Likud, he destroyed the Israeli right. It doesn't exist anymore. It has become Kadima, which, as I said, was formed largely from the Likud.
Right.
Mr. Chandler, let me ask you just quickly. Do you believe that his own personal feelings on that issue changed during the time that he was prime minister, or he was like that from the beginning?
What Sharon said that was very revealing when he was asked by his own party why he would go against, really, his own party really opposed this evacuation, and he said privately, said the American State Department want the Jews out of Gaza, and I can't argue with them. I'm going to do it.
Okay, Mary, that answers it. The policies...
That answers my question. It sounds like the same thing that happened to George Bush, in my opinion.
Yeah, I think you're right. George Bush is told what to do just as well as Sharon was, as Rabin was, as Olmert is today. Hey, thanks so much for calling. Bye-bye. Okay, go right ahead, Barry.
Well, you have very nice callers.
Well, of course we do.
They seem to be on top of the game here.
Right. Well, of course, if they listen to our programs regularly, they probably are some of the best informed people in America. But go right ahead.
He's absolutely right about Sharon. But again, if one of these days you want to do a Sharon show, I've got plenty of information there. I'm gonna switch just to one issue before I go back to Olmert resigning, and that's the bank bailouts, because there are Israeli writers, one in particular by the name of Manny Winston, and I assume they took other writers took the lead from Winston. They're talking about the bailout of the American banking system to the tune of anywhere between $700 billion and $1 trillion.
And I think they're being very conservative. I think it's going to probably, before this is over, take $5 trillion or more, but go right ahead.
$5 trillion, I mean, the American debt is $9 trillion. $5 trillion is a... $1 trillion is a figure I can't...
Right.
It's beyond my conception.
Well, I think one of my supporters really sent me a little note recently, and he said it, I think, best. He says, a trillion here, a trillion there, and pretty soon you're talking about worthless money, and that's what it's all about. They're going to destroy the value of our currency, but that's exactly what they want to do, because how else can they impoverish our people and bring on a global government? But go right ahead.
Well, what Manny Winston wrote was that this is not a bailout of American banks. The American banking system has been bought out in no small way by Arab nations. There are Islamic owners of the majority of American banks, including Merrill Lynch. And what he's saying is that American taxpayers are essentially bailing out Islamic governments.
Isn't that nice of us? We're really such generous people.
Yeah, well, I think it's a point that's worthy of considering.
Because I think it's not only the Arabs, but of course we're bailing out the Chinese communists. We're bailing out the, you know, the Japanese who own lots of this. Certainly the Arabs loan a lot of our bonds, and we're bailing out foreigners who hate us. Why would we do that? Well, I think because the people who are bailing them out hate America as well. But I agree with you totally. I think the Arabs are getting a free pass on this, but I think the Chinese communists, they own trillions of dollars of our debt over here, and the same thing is true with certainly with Japan and Russia. They own a lot of our debt too. So we're bailing out all of our enemies. Isn't that magnanimous?
Well, it's the American taxpayer,
right,
who is bailing out China, Russia, and
the Arabs, right? Abu Dhabi and Dubai and Sydney and Saudi Arabia.
All right, well, that's the point being made from Israel.
And I think they're absolutely right, because they're a little myopic, because they just look at it from the Arab point of view. But all of our enemies we're bailing out. We're going to give them trillions of dollars of American taxpayer money, and what they're going to do is end up leaving us as a third world nation and transferring the wealth and manufacturing of the world to China and to India. That's the plan. It's being carried out masterfully, and there's now one American in 1,000 who has any idea what's really going on.
All right, now let's go back. Briefly, this report that I initially began with on Gaza and Gush Katif, the results, according to Dr. Amina Dor doing the suit, is that the Israeli army lost a war in Lebanon shortly after the disengagement. The army had been so brainwashed not to fight anymore, it lost its first war. Now, the reason I'm going to mention that, and I admit it may be hard for your listeners to follow, but C.P. Livni's opponent was Defense Minister Shlomo Mofaz. Now, really, I mean, Livni is controlled entirely by Condoleezza Rice. And Mofaz he's got a past of his own. But I found out something really upsetting, and it explains a lot. The defense ministry announced today, I got it today, that the gas masks that it collected from all Israeli citizens, and that's in my latest article, it was probably I included in my top five exposés of the past year. The Jewish New Year's next week, and I did a little review of the last year, is that the gas masks were taken from the Israeli people before the Arabs put chemical warheads on thousands of missiles. And, needless to say, that's insanity. But I found out, first of all, the Defense Ministry has announced today that the new gas masks won't be ready until, guess this, the year 2013.
Barry, I don't think it's insanity at all. I think they're setting up the Israeli people for mass extermination with bacteriological and chemical warfare. The people who are engineering this are not stupid, but what they're doing is effectively is demoralizing the Israeli people, just as they play similar games on our people here in America, as they've done with any civil defense for our people, our mobile surgical hospitals. And if we were to have a chemical, biological, or neurological attack here, we would lose countless millions of people because there are no preparations to take care of them. And I think that what they're doing, of course, I fear that the war is coming to Israel, and an awful lot of people are going to die needlessly, and they're being betrayed by their leaders.
Well,
I don't think it's insanity at all.
You could argue you could argue that from their point of view. I'm still looking at the Israeli public's point of view, and somebody out there thinks something is insane that they don't have basic protection against a gas attack.
Right, I agree.
But who took away the gas mask? It was Shlomo Mofaz. Again, he was T.P. Livni's opponent in the Kadima primaries. And yeah. I didn't know this. During the Lebanon War of 2 summers ago, Barak ordered Israelis to break the seals on their gas masks and prepare to use them. Now, once you break the seals, the gas mask is only good for a day. Oops, I hear music.
You do hear music, and so basically what they did is they set up the Israelis. Then, of course, you know, then of course they collected the gas masks. Why not let the people get the gas masks repaired on their own? Why would you collect them and then not give them back again? And I'm sure the Israeli people are smart enough to realize that they're very susceptible to the possibility of chemical and bacteriological warfare. And I personally believe that there are an awful lot of warheads there in Syria and perhaps even over in Lebanon with chemical and biological weapons in them. And why would anybody want to leave the Israeli people susceptible for mass extermination? Unless, of course, there's an intense hatred of Jews someplace. And I think that's what it's about. Our guest this evening has been Barry Shamish. We'll be back in a moment to wrap up the program. Barry, you go right ahead.
Is this the last 3 minutes?
This is the last 3 minutes. Time flies when you're having fun.
Oh, does it, though? Well, I have enough topics, but I should bring up one. This week, Pope Benedictine the 16th, Ratzinger, announced that Pope Pius, the Pope during the Holocaust, took every effort to save Jews. How could he do such a misreading of history as to say that Pope Pius tried to save Jews? There's one thing. He was the Pope until the 50s. When the war ended, the Vatican harbored and gave shelter and sanctuary to something like 100,000 Nazis throughout Europe in their monasteries, and they shipped them off in bulk to South America, Australia, Canada, and the United States with cooperation from the American government, if you were a scientist anyways. How could a pope not know that his Benedictine, Dominican, and Jesuit monasteries were being used to save the Nazis? And he gave this speech, and the really worrisome part is that anyone with a little education would know that he's lying through his teeth. But I guess in this world of ours, there just aren't enough people with the education to say to him, the Pope knew that he was saving the Nazis. What do you mean he was working for the Jews? That would be my final comment on the Vatican. Whatever went on before, when the war ended, the Vatican saved the active Nazis of Europe, and the Pope knew about it.
Well, of course, what happened was there was something called the RAT line, R-A-T, RAT line, by which the CIA, MI5, and a component in the Vatican, I'm not sure what component, but I suspect it was the satanic organizations that worked there, were actually funneling the Nazis to South America, at least 10,000, and certainly the worst of them, Dr. Mengele, Klaus Barbie, Martin Bormann. Hey, we're out of time. That's a subject for another night, Barry. Thanks so very much for being with us. It's always a pleasure to have you. Good night. God bless.
Bye.
Bye-bye. All right, fine. We'll be back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Barry was talking about the smuggling of the Nazis to South America at the end of the Second World War. Most Americans do not know anything about Operation Paperclip, where thousands of Nazi scientists were brought to the United States, and at least 10,000 and perhaps far more scientists, and some of the most brutal war criminals were actually taken to South America with the full help and support of the Central Intelligence Agency and MI6 and a component within the Vatican. And, of course, this is well documented. It's called the Rat Line. You can go up on the Internet and read about it. You'll never hear about it any other place. But, of course, we have a four-tape set called Operation Paperclip that goes into the background of the Nazi scientists who were brought to the United States and the Nazi war criminals, Martin Bormann, Klaus Barbie, Dr. Mengele, Adolf Eichmann, all taken to South America with the full help and support of the American CIA, MI6, and the component within the Vatican. Why would they do that? Well, what everybody has missed, of course, is the occult organizations have always worked with the intelligence agencies and their occult organizations in both the Catholic and the Protestant churches. And, Sidney, if you'd like to learn more about this subject, I suggest you call us at 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-544-8927, and get the Operation Paperclip four-tape set. It's nothing quite like it out there. Information you need to have to understand what's going on today. But then, of course, you need to get our four-tape set on the Bilderbergers. Actually, I think that comes in CD as well. We have a four-tape set on the Bohemian Grove. And some of these are available in CDs. Most of them are available. They're all available in tapes. We have a DVD on the Bilderbergers. We have a DVD on the Bohemian Grove. And certainly there you'll see the people, certainly with their robes and their hoods and their chanting and their mystical ceremonies and their feigned human sacrifice. And these things are not imaginary. There really are secret societies out there. And the Bohemian Grove, of course, they revere, at least according to their own writings, the owl, the 40-foot owl, which is a symbol of Moloch, the ancient demonic god. Why would the people in the Bohemian Grove do that? Because working with all of these organizations are the dark occult forces. And certainly you need, of course, to get my book, The Brotherhood of Darkness, or the CD on that, or the video. You need to get the talk on the forbidden secret and the syllabus that goes with that and the talk on this secret knowledge. You need to get the talk on the planned police state and the syllabus because it has all the documentation of the concentration camps and what they're doing. And you need to have it at your fingertips so you can show it to others. And you've got to be out there on the front lines, and you have to have the information, and you have my permission to copy anything we've produced as long as you're not selling it, and help us get the information out across America. So again, that's the Brotherhood of Darkness, the Forbidden Secret, the Secret Knowledge, and the Planned Police State. Our number, 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-544-8927, and please don't forget that we're having an all-day seminar here in the North Shore of Monterey Bay on October the 26th at the Aptos Seascape Golf Course. We're serving lunch. We're bringing in speakers from all across the country. We hope to get a good turnout. And if you can come and bring your friends, why, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. If you're coming from elsewhere, we'll provide you with a map and make suggestions as to a good place to stay. And you still have a few days to get the special rate at the local Seascape Inn. That's the Seascape Inn. We recommend it to you, the Sea Cliff Inn, I should say. And then, of course, we ask you, of course, to go to our